This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Five personal takeaways from the crisis and how it changed conventional wisdom. First, investors do not act rationally in a crisis. They don't buy low and sell high. They buy high and they sell low. In the week of March 6, 2009, the S&P hit 666. Yikes, a drop of more than 50% off the historic high. It made no sense at all to sell with the market down 50%, but that's exactly what happened. Outflows from mutual funds accelerated towards the end of 2008 into the first quarter of 2009. The flows did not turn positive until later that year. That hurt. Second, there isn't always a right price. When the mortgage-backed security market fell apart, no one could agree on how to price the derivatives that were at the heart of the crisis. The mortgage market seized up, and that affected other credit markets. Third, increasing complexity does not decrease risk. It increases the risk. Everyone thought you could slice and dice mortgage products into these manageable tranches that would spread out all the risk. That proved to be terribly wrong. Fourth, the markets are not as efficient as everybody assumed. Wall Street had very poor visibility throughout all of this. I saw it. Corporations were seeing business deteriorate on an almost daily basis, and poor communication and data sharing from the companies themselves exacerbated the problem. Many companies provided little, if any, guidance and shared as little as information as possible, and the analysts were terribly wrong on their estimates. Finally, bold, swift action works better than slow, indecisive action or no action at all. The Fed stepped in to make sure banks would not fail, and that finally stopped the free fall. And in a sense, you know, John Maynard Keynes did win out. Governments around the world stepped in, propped up critical institutions, and they spent a lot of money. And I would note that global central banks did this as well. And we're still debating the effects of that.
And that was Bob Pisani commenting on the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis, a topic that we're going to be covering today. Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Big Picture. And today's show really is a big one. It's just hard to believe that 10 years ago this week, the world's financial system was on the brink of collapse with the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. And it set off a daisy chain of bankruptcies throughout the financial system, from AIG to Merrill Lynch, and many other large financial institutions going under as well. It necessitated trillion-dollar bailouts by the government and ultimately taxpayers. So here we are 10 years later. Global debt is up almost 40%. There's more debt today than existed 10 years ago. Too big to fail, our financial institutions got even bigger, and equity valuations are once again extremely high. Just look at Amazon and Netflix, and like then, the Fed is once again raising interest rates. So, can another debt crisis emerge? If so, what will it look like? And what tools will authorities have at their disposal to rescue us from the abyss?
You know, it's hard to believe that 10 years has gone by since the financial crisis began, and it really accelerated on September 15th in 2008 when Lehman Brothers filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, setting off a cascade of bankruptcies that even the authorities were not even prepared for. And through an alphabet set of bailout initiatives, cutting interest rates from 5% down to zero, and starting out with QE, with the first tranche of $1.2 trillion of money printing. And of course, that was followed by a fiscal spending package, and that's what it took for a recovery, $2 trillion. $1 trillion of government spending, and more than $1 trillion of Fed printing. And folks, that's exactly what we have now. With the exception of Fed printing, we have almost $2 trillion of fiscal stimulus coming at the end of a business cycle. Now, the Fed, and here's the interesting thing, would keep interest rates at a 0%, think about this, for 8 years, impacting the savings of millions of Americans, and they would expand their balance sheet to $4.5 trillion only recently, as it had begun to shrink that balance sheet, raising interest rates only gradually. It's not like it was when Greenspan's time, where he could double the Fed funds rate in a single year, as he did in 1994, or raise interest rates only a quarter of a point every quarter. The Fed right now is on track to raise interest rates only once every quarter, keenly aware, with an indebted economy, their actions could precipitate the very next crisis they would want the ammunition to fight. So since the last crisis, and here's the myth that you've heard, well, we've been deleveraging, we're getting rid of debt. No, we haven't gotten rid of debt. The only difference is asset prices are up 3 or 4-fold, so the debt looks less onerous. If you take a look, since the crisis began in 2007, global debt has been growing at 5% a year, where global growth has only been growing at 3% a year. According to the latest McKinsey report, global debt was at $87 trillion in the year 2000. It grew to $142 trillion in 2007. It reached $199 trillion by the middle of 2014. And as of the end of last year, it was at $217 trillion and still growing. So debt has essentially grown by 50% since the last debt crisis, which makes it more likely we're going to experience another debt crisis in the not-too-distant future, because when we get into these debt crises, it is and will continue to be throughout history. It's all about debt and credit.
Well, Jim, given that possibility that we are likely going to experience another debt crisis here at some point, what are the lessons we can learn from these events? And what are the signs that another debt storm is approaching? We're hearing all the news about Hurricane Florence, and we know that we're able to detect storms in the weather like Hurricane Florence. I imagine there's probably also similar signs when it comes to detecting financial storms.
And there are, Chris, and I want to cover this perspective today with a new book that was released this week by Ray Dalio, who manages the world's largest and most successful fund, whose own fund successfully managed to do well throughout the entire financial crisis, making not only a fortune for himself, but also for his clients. His new book is called A Template for Understanding Big Debt Crises. And here's the best part. This book is free. You know, I was thinking about that, Chris. Why would you give away a book free? But then, you know, I'm thinking about it. If you're a multi-billionaire, who needs the money? And the best part, we are going to make the link to download this book. We're going to put it on our podcast webpage. So take advantage of it, because it is something you're definitely going to want to read if you're a money manager or you have substantial assets in the markets.
You know, there's basically six stages. There's the normal debt growth that finances growth that pays for itself. Then you get into the bubble stage when everybody's extrapolating what happened in the past. So asset prices are going up and everybody's borrowing a lot of money to extrapolate what's happened. And that bubble stage, central banks don't pay much attention to because it doesn't affect inflation and growth. And so I think at that stage is when the central bank should be looking at, are those debts going to be able to be paid back from the financial? That would be the biggest.
Now, in that interview, he was asked about debt levels here in the United States, and he seemed a little more sanguine about our debt.
You know, Chris, if we take a look at what he was probably saying there, in the next crisis, it's probably not going to come from the banking sector like the last one. The banks are fairly well capitalized. They've been restrained by regulation from the kind of speculative actions. Think about no-doc loans and the crazy stuff that was going on in the last one. And also, you know, we had Dodd-Frank came in. So there were a lot of handcuffs that were sort of placed on banks. In fact, the pullback from trading is given away to another issue, which is market liquidity, a topic we've covered here on the show. So the next crisis will be, in my opinion, it's going to be in public pensions at the state level. Our own Governor Jerry Brown here said the next recession will create a pension crisis in California, which is woefully underfunded its pension by the tune of several hundred billion dollars. And it's also going to be in financial asset liquidity, most especially with index funds and ETFs and in the emerging market where debt, as we're seeing, we'll talk about this in inflationary recessions, where much of that debt was borrowed in U.S. dollars. And think about it. And one of the reasons that took place is emerging markets were growing much faster than developed economies. And when the Fed brought interest rates down to zero, it was cheaper to borrow money in dollars. Well, that comes back to haunt you when it goes in the opposite direction. So that's in the next crisis. They're similar in nature in terms of how they unfold, which is what we're going to discuss here on the program and what Dalio discusses in his book. There's a template in terms of the pattern they follow, but each one of them is different in their own right and also different in the way policymakers respond to them.
Well, Jim, let's get into Ray Dalio's template for understanding debt crises so we can really get a better understanding about what causes them and even how they unfold.
Well, there are basically, Dalio boils this down to seven-stage process that is common to both deflationary and inflationary debt cycles. Stage one is the early stage of the cycle. That's the boom. Picture the economy recovering from a recession. Things start to pick up. Asset markets start to rise. The good times are finally upon us. Everybody's saying, oh my goodness, we're out of the recession. We're out of the depression. People are starting to feel better. The second stage is what we call the bubble stage. That's when everybody gets excited and things get extended, whether it is borrowing money at cheap rates, overpaying for assets as we're doing now. The third phase is the top. At one point, usually when you're getting to the top, the cycle is beginning to reverse because at this point, the central bank is coming in. They're raising interest rates as they're doing now, so they're taking away the punch bowl. The fourth phase is what we call the recession or depression phase. That's when you get to the bust. The economy is in a recession. The stock market is in a bear market. Stage five, Dalio calls the beautiful deleveraging. And that's when just the right amount of monetary stimulus is put into place that it doesn't create any kind of hyperinflations as you're seeing today in Argentina, Venezuela, and soon Turkey. The sixth phase, and this is the one that central banks want to avoid, and that is called pushing on a string. Interest rates are down to zero, and central banks have to resort to alternative policies, in which they did in the last crisis. The Fed brought the Fed funds rate down to 0%. But then they got into what they called quantitative easing, which is just a fancy name for printing money. They just began to print money out of thin air, buying long-term bonds and mortgages in an effort to drive down long-term interest rates. Because short-term interest rates, there was nothing else they could do. They already brought them down to zero. Stage seven is when you finally come out of the crisis, and it's called normalization. Things are back to normal, and the next cycle begins. So if you look at it, most debt crises follow this similar pattern, and they have acted very similarly throughout human history, from biblical times to the Roman Empire to the present day. And here's the key point. They're all related to the giving and buying of credit, because what credit does, it creates additional buying power. Just think about it. Let's say you have $50,000 that you make a year. Or let's make it even easier. Let's say you have $100,000. You make $100,000. That gives you $100,000 of buying power that you can buy goods and services. However, if you go into the market, borrow money from your bank, put purchases on credit, let's say you go out and borrow $20,000, either through credit cards, a home equity loan, what have you done? You've increased your purchasing power from $100,000 to $120,000. But here's how all cycles end, because in the end, unless your income increases well beyond $120,000, you're going to eventually have to pay that $20,000 you borrowed back. And what does that mean? It means less spending in the future, because credit creates additional buying power. What unfolds as debt builds is whether that debt is used for productive purposes, think of infrastructure, investments in the economy, which generate the income to service the debt, or in the speculative stage or the bubble phase, it often goes into speculation and consumption. And that's where you get into the crisis stage.
Okay, so I see why that's a crisis, but why are they a cycle that repeats? Maybe not in the same way, but recurring over and over again throughout history.
You know, as Dalio points out, they're neither predestined to repeat exactly the same way, and the pattern of borrowing spending is more than you make, then having to spend less than you make to pay that debt back in the future. Everybody knows, and if you've ever been in this problem, I don't need to tell you what it's like. You borrow a bunch of money, you take out home equity loans, you take out credit cards, maybe you have a medical emergency, you're putting kids through school, but you borrow a lot more money than you're making. Well, what does that mean? It means that now you've added to your monthly budget debt payments. And those debt payments can get bigger as the Fed raises interest rates. In stage one of the boom, and when it starts, in the upswing, lending supports spending and investment, which in turn supports higher incomes, higher asset prices. As income and asset prices increase, guess what that does? That supports more borrowing and spending on goods and financial assets. The borrowing increases, it does a couple of things as it's doing now. It increases economic growth, as it's doing now in the U.S. economy. And as the cycle approaches, the peak additional lending is made on the assumption, and here's the problem, that the present trends will continue, which we know they do not. Asset prices become overvalued, they get into bubble territory, and the classic sign of a bubble is that borrowing is being done to make debt payments. In other words, you're not borrowing to buy stuff anymore. You're borrowing money, and you see this often with financial institutions or companies. They're borrowing money just to simply have enough money to make their interest payments. And you see this in the junk bond market all the time. When debt service payments become greater than the amount that can be borrowed to finance spending, the cycle goes into reverse and the crisis begins.
Now, once the crisis does begin, how do authorities handle that and resolve it? And Jim, before you answer the question, I meant to ask you, are there correct or just different ways to respond which would make the crisis worse? I'll give you an example why I bring that up. By now, saving Lehman, the crisis became much worse, and it triggered a chain reaction that made the crisis far worse, where the year before, they bailed out Bear Stearns.
You know, that is an issue, and in a lot of people looking back at the crisis often wonder why the Fed allowed Lehman to go under, because, you know, some say, well, they didn't have the authority. They could have handled it. They didn't. I think the thinking is, well, eventually we just can't bail out everybody, and so just let the chips fall where they may. Well, as soon as that happened, it began a debt spiral and chain daisy chain reaction. You saw Lehman go under, then it was AIG going under, and then you saw Merrill Lynch go under, and one financial institution after another just began falling like dominoes. So this time around, I don't think they would allow something like a Lehman to go under, and especially today, the institutions are much bigger, but you know, as a result of the financial crisis, they're better capitalized and there's been greater restrictions. But what Dalio talks about in his book, when you get into these debt crises, as we were in 2007 and 2009, there are basically only four policy responses, and we've seen them in various forms in just the last 10 years, which policymakers can use to bring the debt and debt service down relative to income, because what you're trying to do is make it affordable for whoever took on the debt, whether it was corporations, financial institutions, or in the case of Europe, actually governments, that you bring it down so the cash flow levels are able to service the debt. So there's four ways they do it. Number one is austerity, spending less, and this usually does not work. It's very severe on the economy. The economy contracts, people lose their jobs, there's less income. This, I have very seldom seen it work. They tried to do this in the European debt crisis with Greece, and it was a disaster. Number two is debt default and restructuring. You saw this eventually with Greece, where a lot of the debts of the heavily indebted country were restructured at a lower interest rate that had made it more affordable to meet their debt payments. Number three, which we saw in the last crisis, the central bank just simply prints a bunch of money and makes guarantees. We saw this in 2008 when they backstopped the commercial paper market. They backstopped money market funds. They were backstopping financial institutions. I think Bloomberg did a story where the pledges and backstops totaled almost $9 trillion. So that's how serious the last crisis. We really came, Chris, close to the precipice of the cliff. People had no idea how close we were to having the entire globe's financial system collapse. The fourth, it's very unpopular and it has really poor outcomes. And that's simply transferring money and credit from those who have it to those who don't. And it normally craters the economy. That's just, this is what you see in socialism, where you just go in and you take from the haves and you say, we're just going to give it to the have-nots. The problem is you destroy incentives, you distort the economy, and you have what you're seeing going on today in Venezuela. And Chris, this is one reason we spend so much time here on the program covering the Fed, because the Fed is the entity that makes the availability of credit, and it's controlled primarily by the central bank. So every debt crisis in one form or another is always related to the expansion of credit. If we didn't have the expansion of credit, we wouldn't have debt crises.
Now, of those four stages or responses that you mentioned, where do you think we are in the present cycle?
You know, if we think close to, you know, our opinion is we're probably close to the seventh inning in this cycle, we would probably be in the ninth inning had it not been for the massive fiscal stimulus that came in through tax cuts and additional government spending. In our view, probably late 2019, but most likely 2020 is when this cycle will come to an end. So in our opinion, we're probably in the seventh inning, a view also shared by Ray Dalio.
Generally speaking, we're in, I would say, the seventh inning of this cycle. I think that we're at the stage in the cycle where interest rates are being raised.
Right.
We're in the later stage, probably maybe we have two more years, I would say, into the cycle, right, something like that.
Now, Jim, I know from previous programs we've done here, it's because of this stimulus that you don't believe we're in danger of a recession or bear market until at least the middle of next year, maybe year end 2019. But you also believe the Fed will do what it always does, which is to keep raising interest rates until they break something. But Dalio discussed this in a recent interview.
1937, we begin a tightening cycle. We begin a tightening cycle at this point. No tightening cycle ever works out perfectly. That's why we have recessions. We can't get it perfectly. So as we're going into this particular cycle, we have to start to think, well, what will the next downturn be like? We're 9 years into this. As you have a downturn, I believe that there's a political and social implications to that related to populism and less effective monetary policy.
So let's go through each of these stages, Jim, briefly. And I want to remind our listeners that we have posted a link to a free download of Dalio's book on our podcast page at financialsense.com.
Well, let's take a look. There's seven stages. Stage one is the early stage of the cycle. This is where you're basically coming out of the recession. Think of the summer 2009. In March of that year, the president authorized a $1 trillion fiscal package. The Fed got rid of mark-to-market accounting. They initiated QE1, and they said over the next 12 months, we're going to print $1.2 trillion. So the economy began to recover. And at this stage, debt is not growing faster than income. People are a little bit reluctant coming out of a recession to add a whole bunch of debt right away. But the debt that is being used is used for productive use in the economy and for making investments. Debt burdens are very low. Balance sheets are healthy, which enables the private and the government sector to kind of leverage up. Neither economic growth, inflation, or debt growth is either too hot or too cold. Stage two, and this is when things really begin to heat up. And to me, this began in probably around 2014. Debt is rising faster than incomes, giving way to accelerating asset returns and economic growth. And of course, that reinforces rising incomes, rising net worth, asset prices, and asset values. And as these asset values increase, it allows the ability of borrowers to borrow more money because you have more equity. Everyone feels they're getting richer. Everyone is spending more than they earn. They're buying assets with leverage, think of margin, and they believe the trends will continue indefinitely. And this is so, so important to understand if you're an investor out there. The tops and the beginning of the next bear market and recession always begin when things look like things couldn't be any better and will only get better in the future. It is usually at this point you're at the top. The tops don't begin when things are miserable, people are feeling depressed, they're scared. They're usually when people are feeling very optimistic about the future. Consumer confidence is high, business confidence is high, the economic numbers look good, but underneath the surface, there are signs that things are beginning to flip. Everybody is spending more than they earn. They're buying assets with leverage because they believe the trends in place are going to continue indefinitely. And the reason always makes this possible is the central banks is keeping interest rates low. Now think about this. The Fed brought interest rates down to zero, and they kept them at zero for 8 years. And even when the Fed began to raise interest rates, they did so only once a year. They raised interest rates once in 2015 and once in 2016. I mean, big deal. What did that do? They took the Fed funds rate from 0 to 0.5%. It was still cheap to borrow, which is what was going on in emerging markets. So this is the stage where, because interest rates are so cheap, I mean, think of if you're a hedge fund manager, you can borrow money for less than 1%. Heck, I could just put it in a blue chip stock and make a dividend that's 3 or 4% and get 4 times what it cost me to borrow. And that's what brings in the speculators. Speculators enter into the picture. More investors come into the markets, not wanting to miss out on the opportunity to get rich. Think of index investors today as a good example of this. At this stage, you also see credit standards fall. You see loan covenants on bond issues are weakened. Credit spreads narrow. In other words, you're getting very little money to take additional risk. And players like the shadow banking system enter into the economy making loans, and they do so more freely because they're less regulated. You see, asset mismatches, the classic, is you borrow short term, but you lend long term. You see a lot of this in the financial sector. Or you're investing in less liquid assets like you're seeing in many of the bond funds and the bond ETFs, which is going to be a major issue for investors in the next downturn. You're seeing also investments in riskier assets. Think of junk bond funds or illiquid ones. Debt is beginning to rise faster. Debt service rises even faster because what's happening, the Fed is raising the cost of borrowing. It's hard to believe in the summer of 2016, Treasury bills were actually negative. Today, they're 2.5% to close to 3%. At this stage, however, the crowd mentality takes over the market because everyone is thinking the good times will last forever and we're all going to end up getting rich.
Well, and Jim, you had talked about speculation going wild. I noticed that in his book, Dalio lays out clues for spotting bubbles. I want to go over just a few of those, which I think will be interesting to our listeners. Number one, prices are high relative to traditional measures. He lists number two, that prices are extrapolated to continue at a rapid pace. Number three is broad-based bullish sentiment. Number four, purchases are financed by high leverage. And number five, buyers make big forward purchases from inventory to speculative bets in the market. Number six, new buyers enter the market. And finally, for number seven, monetary policy remains extremely stimulative.
Yeah, it's at this point when many of the factors are visible, you know you've reached the top. Everything looks good. Once again, this is so important. The downturns, the bear markets will begin before you know you're in a recession, they'll begin before you know you're in a bear market. A good example is in 2007, the stock market peaked in late September, early October. The recession began in January, and we weren't really talking about the crisis until the fall of 2008 when Lehman Brothers went under, which was 10 years ago on the 15th. So when everything looks so good, They can't get better, yet everyone believes that they will get better. That is when you know the top is being put in place. At this point, growth is accelerating, as we're seeing now. We're growing now at 4%. The central bank starts tightening more aggressively, as we're seeing now. The Fed has gone from tightening one time to three times last year to four times this year, and it does so more aggressively. And usually the pace of tightening picks up about 6 months before the top. At this point, and here's another one that we're starting to see, cash becomes more attractive. So the question then arises is how much tightening before the bubble burst? Our own opinion, it's going to take a lot less time this time around. And let me just give you an idea, because several of these things are now in place. And I just want to go to, let me go to my Bloomberg screen here and just give you an idea. 3-month Treasury bills are at 2.15, 2-year Treasury notes at almost 2.8%. Chris, I can remember 2 years ago when 2-year Treasury notes were about 0.25%, 3-month T-bills were actually negative. So as you get into these latter stages, cash becomes a more important asset and becomes attractive as an asset class. Because remember, up to this point, we were operating under TINA, which is there is no alternative to stocks.
So the bubble bursts with psychology reversing, as now every bit of news coming out, whether it's a weakening economy, higher unemployment, maybe corporate earnings misses, but it triggers sell-offs in the market as the economy heads in a recession or, God forbid, a depression.
Yeah, this is the stage when the economy is in recession, and that's what everybody knew very well by the time we were in the latter part of 2008, especially as the financial crisis accelerated. And it also, the bear market. Stocks were peaked in the fall of 2007. In 2008, they were starting to fall, and then they just fell off a cliff after Lehman. The whole process reverses. Everything that happens leading up to the bubble reverses on the downside. Debtors have trouble servicing debt. Many of them default on their debts, unable to roll over debt or meet their debt payments. Panic selling starts to come in the market. Credit contracts. Lenders pull back on extending credit because they're losing money. People are defaulting. They're not making their debt service payments. Spending is curtailed as the economy heads into recession. People lose their jobs, go on unemployment. Spenders are now stuck with those debt payments. At the same time, they're seeing the asset values that supported them decline in value. The Fed usually at this point is slashing interest rates, trying to ease the debt burdens, which brings us to the next stage, what Dalio calls a beautiful deleveraging. Now, the perfect deleveraging, and they don't always turn this way, is when there's just the right amount of stimulation and printing of money and debt monetization. The best way, according to Dalio, for the central bank to avoid a depression is to provide adequate liquidity. Just think of people get scared when you saw those financial institutions go under in 2008. They start lining up to get their money out of the bank. The Fed has to inject large amounts into the bank. Otherwise, you have a banking crisis similar to the 1930s. So they provide liquidity. They provide credit support. And for the government, it also supports monetary policy with fiscal policy. That's what we got in 2009 when Obama and Congress authorized $1 trillion of fiscal spending, and that's what makes where we're at now so unusual. You've got $2 trillion of fiscal stimulus coming at a time that monetary policy is working against it. Now, think back to 2009 of what was going on then, and we were coming out of it. Everybody thought the end was there. In fact, probably for the first couple of years after the crisis, everybody thought another crisis was around the corner. They didn't realize the crisis had already passed. The market was already down 60%, home prices were down 40%, and the Fed was reliquefying the financial system, and that was causing asset prices to rise. So basically, at this point, the Fed is printing enough money to offset contracting credit and credit destruction through default or either restructuring. The key, and this is important to this form of deleveraging, is not to overdo it, because if you overdo it, it's like cocaine, it's a drug. Politicians could become addicted to it, promising more than they can deliver and just printing the money to pay for it. And you can see this today in Venezuela, Turkey, Argentina, or the U.S. in the 70s which created an inflationary recession. So basically, when you get into these kind of crises, there's basically three kinds of monetary responses. Typically, until the last crisis, the first monetary response, which is simply to lower interest rates. Typically, the Fed funds rate would be at 6%. The Fed would lower it down to 3%, and the economy would recover. In 2001, Greenspan brought the Fed funds rate down from 6% down to 1%, gradually raised it back up to 5%, and then the Fed brought it down to 1%. But in the last crisis, they had to take interest rates down to 0%, and it still wasn't enough, which brings us to the second monetary response, which is quantitative easing, and that is printing money, buying financial assets, typically debt. And what the Fed did is it brought mortgages in the market and it bought federal treasuries. And what that did is it brought down long-term interest rates to the point in the summer of 2016, we hit the lowest point in recorded human history when the 10-year treasury got down to roughly 1.3%. That's the second response. The third response is what we call helicopter money. And that's simply they put money in the hands of consumers. It could be a tax cut. The government could slash taxes, as we just did, which means you take home more pay out of your paycheck. That's putting dollars in your pocket, and they create incentives for you to spend that money. And then the Fed just simply comes in and monetizes the debt that the government uses to pay for that additional spending. And that's when you get to helicopter money. And it's very dangerous because when you get to helicopter money, you could be on the borderline if crisis is lost in the currency that you could have an inflationary recession versus a deflationary one.
Based on what you've mentioned, the obvious questions are, what do we do now? Should we be defensive and should the Fed stop now? Well, let's listen to Dalio on these topics.
If you raise rates now, all the rate structure is affected and carries through all markets.
Right.
Because we're all discount, it's a discount rate for the present value of all asset classes. No. I think you have to start to think of what monetary policy three is, which is, you know, particularly in Japan, you're going to need it. But the type of thing where there's, it's not just the purchase of financial assets. It gets individuals to make their purchases assets. The upside is a little bit, is limited relative to the others.
Meaning you would pull money out of the market or you just wouldn't deploy the capital?
Right now, whatever is more defensive, I would then be in a more defensive posture. Whatever your strategic asset allocation issue is, you know what your strategic mix is.
Right.
I would be less aggressive rather than more aggressive.
So, Jim, let's move on to the inflationary debt crises.
You know, the main difference between the two is mostly inflationary debt crises take place in countries where the debt is denominated in another currency. And this is one of the issues we brought up on this program, that where you're going to see the crises emerge, and we're seeing them already play out in Turkey and the countries we mentioned, is when the debt that you take on is denominated in another currency. And one of the reasons you do that is capital flows. And you think of when the Fed was keeping interest rates down to zero, it was cheaper to borrow in dollars, not to mention the fact the dollar was going down in value. So meaning that if you had to pay your loan back, let's say you borrowed $100,000 in U.S. dollars, the dollar lost 20% of its value with Fed QE initially. That means your $100,000 debt you could pay back with $80,000. So it encourages a lot of countries to borrow in another currency. And it's great when it's going in one direction. And it's only when you get a lot of that debt denominated in another currency, which is what is going on in emerging markets today, where the vast majority of the debt increases globally have occurred. So this creates two problems. You not only have the problem of rising rates in your own currency, but you also have the problem of rising rates in the currency you borrowed in. And that's exactly what is happening to emerging markets around the globe today. Much of that money has been borrowed in dollars. And who's raising interest rates the most? Interest rates are higher in the U.S. than they are in Asia. They're higher here than they are in Europe. So that creates a problem. This is one of the issues we have been pointing out here with emerging markets, because they are heavily indebted in dollars. So the currency dynamic is what produces the inflationary outcome. And the second important dynamic is capital flows. Because when things are hot, money is moving into emerging markets. So let's say people are taking dollars, they're moving into an emerging market, they're exchanging their dollars for the currency of the emerging market. What is that doing? Money is coming into the country. The currency of that country is rising. Investments are coming into the country. The economy is booming. Well, think about what happens in the reverse. At some point, the currency becomes uncompetitive. Exports fall because they're no longer competitive because of the currency rising. And then things begin to flip in the opposite direction. Trouble begins to emerge. Eventually, rates have to rise in the emerging economy. They start raising rates to protect the currency. As they're doing that, the economy begins to slow down, exports slow down, the economy begins to get itself in trouble. Foreign investors sense this. They begin pulling money out. As they pull money out, the value of the currency declines, which creates a lot more inflation. So everything that we're talking about, you can see take place today. Just look at what is going on in Venezuela, where you have hyperinflation. Just take a look at Turkey, where you have inflation rates of 30 to 40%. Take a look at Argentina, where you have very much the same. And that's why I think that you're seeing the social unrest that you're seeing. It's beginning in Turkey. You're seeing it in Argentina. You definitely see it in Venezuela, where the government is using troops to basically put down riots because people are starving. There's no money. There's hyperinflation. There's a shortage of goods. And this is something that I think you're seeing a little bit of it emerge right here in the U.S. on college campuses, on protests, and you're seeing civil unrest. And that's something that Dalio talks about in the next downturn. He could see civil unrest.
But the next downturn is going to be a different type of downturn. I think pension problems, healthcare problems in terms of obligations that are not funded, that are not debt.
More severe next time?
I think it'll be more severe in terms of the social, political problems, and I think it'll be more difficult to handle. It won't be like the same in terms of the big bang debt crisis. It'll be a slower growing, more constricting sort of debt crisis that I think will have bigger social implications and a bigger international implications.
As we talked about the right ways and the wrong ways to do it in a deflationary recession, there's a right and wrong way to do it in a inflationary recession. When you're in the bubble, the way to manage it, central banks consider growth and debt and its impact on asset markets. And this is really important because you saw this when the bubble burst in 2007. Alan Greenspan said, it's not the central bank's responsibility to spot asset bubbles. Sorry, Alan, you're wrong. It is your responsibility. If they can prevent the bubble, then they can prevent the bust. So central banks always should use policies to target restraints and debt growth where bubbles are emerging. The wrong way is bubbles are fueled by speculators and lenders extrapolating the past well into the future, and interest rates are kept artificially low, enabling the speculators to speculate and create the bubble at the top. The right way is for central banks to constrict the bubble either with the control of monetary policy, with good chosen policies that make the debt burdens less. The wrong way is central banks continue to tighten well after bursting the bubble. This is what you saw happen in Europe, which ended up leading to the European debt crisis and the pig crisis in 2011. Depression. In a depression, central banks provide liquidity, they ease short-term rates until they hit zero, and then they use aggressive targeted policies at assets, and government stimulus comes in supported by debt monetization. Poorly managed central banks are slow to cut rates, slow to provide liquidity, pursue austerity programs. Think of what they were doing in Europe with Greece in 2011. And they fail to support key institutions. Think of the Fed allowing Lehman to go under. Beautiful deleveraging is just the right amount of monetary stimulus, asset purchases, liquidity policies designed to protect important entities and institutions. The wrong way, monetizations are never steady. Stimulation of the central bank is undermined by fiscal austerity, political discord. Over-indebted entities are protected even though they are not systemically important. In other words, everybody's protected, not just key institutions. So, Chris, there's a right and wrong way to do this, and there is a good example.
Well, and Dalio mentions a few ways that we can go. How do you personally, Jim, how do you feel things will play out?
Well, if we look at where we are today, and we've talked about this, we began talking about this last year because this is where all the attention of our firm is focused on. The bubble is in index funds and ETFs. That's where the big selling depression is going to come from. Second, in the next crisis, you're going to see a pension crisis at the municipal and state level. California's pension liabilities are underfunded by several hundred billion dollars. And you're going to see defined benefit plans come apart at the municipal and state level. Three, I think you're going to see liquidity problems, and possibly with the Fed coming in, buying assets such as stocks or illiquid bonds, a subject we're going to talk in detail at our fall conference. Four, which makes the liquidity issue even bigger, is financial concentration. As I mentioned, almost 90% of the S&P is controlled by three entities. Four banks control the derivatives. Five institutions control 60% of the financial assets. So it's more concentrated this time around. Five, you're going to see social unrest. You're already seeing it now. It's going to get worse. Six, political response by basically politicians that don't understand how the economy works. And this is where the biggest risk is. And Dalio talks about poor policy choices can extend and make the recession into a depression. And that's what you just hope for, that there's enough sharp financial minds in government that can steer whoever's running the administration in charge, steer them away from making bad policy choices. So you hope there's enough smart people that can guide whatever administration is in power at the time this thing hits. And then seven is, unfortunately, is the financial press is illiterate, not to mention politically biased. And so what do? When something happens, they overdramatize every single event. You get 24-hour news coverage where they're going to scare the bejeebers out of you. And so this is how we see the next crisis unfolding. And Chris, the most important thing an individual can do, because we're already seeing signs that we're in the seventh inning. Are you smart enough to wait to the ninth inning, the bottom half of the ninth inning, when you're going to have your exit plan? You better have an exit plan in place now and gradually start moving in that plan, just as Ray Dalio said there. And they said, okay, given what you see right now in the seventh inning, what would you be doing? He's saying, we're acting defensively. And this was the guy that navigated the last financial crisis and did not lose money. He actually made a fortune in it. And that's what you should be doing now. You should be developing your exit plan. Do it now. And don't think you're smart enough to wait to the bottom of the ninth inning. I know very few people that are.
He wrote the article Trains, Planes, and Dot-Coms, detailing the euphoria in technology stocks and the bubble it represented 3 months before the peak in the NASDAQ. He wrote the article The Next Big Thing in April of 2002, pointing out the crossroads of a bear market fueled by monetary expansion, only to birth the next bull market in commodities. He wrote yet another prescient article in December of 2006 called The Next Rogue Wave, detailing the out-of-control credit expansion in developed economies a year before the global financial crisis began. You may know him from his weekly financial podcast, The Financial Sense NewsHour. Jim Poplava has been educating the public on personal finances, investing, and the financial markets for over 30 years. He closed off his seminars to the public to focus only on his clients. Now, for the first time since the 90s, he is opening up his wealth of knowledge on the markets back to the public and invites you to a seminar, the Financial Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference, this October at the Hilton Del Mar. This is one seminar you won't want to miss. Call 888-486-3939 for more information, or tune in now to his podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour, on iTunes and iHeartMedia to hear what he's saying now.
Well, that concludes this week's show. We do want to thank you for listening today. Don't forget that Dalio's book called A Template for Understanding Big Debt Crises is available on our website. Just go to www.financialsense.com. And Jim, for the week ahead, anything we should be focusing on?
You know, the week ahead, we're going to be in the middle of the month that we will be ending Q3. It's expected economic growth is probably close to 4%. Coming up at the end of the month will be the Fed meeting, where it's widely expected they'll raise interest rates for the third time this year and give us probably more clues with the accompanying press conference that they're going to raise them again in December. We're also, Chris, getting into, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to get into pre-announcements for Q3 earnings season. So that will begin at the end of this month. And then, of course, we got the rejiggering of all the financial indexes, the new communication service index. Tech will be downsized. So we had that takes place on the 28th on a Friday and will happen and go into effect on October 1st. But that is pretty much it for the rest of this month. And of course, we are in the middle of silly season. We are 2 months away from the November elections, and that's when you start seeing all those crazy ads on TV where each side portrays the other side is the worst villain that has ever been on the planet. So get ready for silly season. You're going to get a lot of it. You'll probably get sick of it by the time you get to elections. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.